We're speaking now with two members of the Rock Creek Alliance. We have with us Mary Costello, the Executive Director. Mary, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
And Diane Williams. Diane, you are a board member, as I understand.
Well, actually not. I'm one of the original founders of the Rock Creek Alliance, along with Mary. But
okay.
I'm more of an advisory role.
Okay, gotcha. But you are, as you mentioned, one of the co-founders. And the purpose of actually of this interview is that the Rock Creek Alliance is coming up on a big celebration of its 25th anniversary. That's on August 25th, just a week away as this airs. And that's going to be at Trinity City Beach, and we're going to tell a bit more about that later on. But first, I thought we would start at the start. And that is, Dan, why don't you take this question as one of the co-founders? So how and why did the Rock Creek Alliance get started 25 years ago?
Yes, it's hard to believe it's been 25 years. But basically what happened is Mary was working for another nonprofit environmental group over in Heron, Montana. At the time, I was working in Sandpoint at the time for a different environmental group. And we both met actually during a tour of the Troy Mine near Libby, Montana. And we realized we were both from Ohio and had both gone to Kent State University. And anyway, that little meeting led to us having a long discussion about the proposed Rock Creek Mine underneath the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness. We both felt it was a really inappropriate place for such a huge copper silver mine. And we knew that folks down in the Sandpoint area were going to be more passionate about, once they learned about the effects of the mine, potentially to Lake Ponderay. And neither one of our organizations had the resources or the inclination to really engage and take the Rock Creek Mine as a sole project. Nor did they have the resources to really engage the Sandpoint community. So Mary and I decided to form the Rock Creek Alliance and drummed up some support from a number of local organizations and founded the organization.
So at the time the Rock Creek Alliance got started 25 years ago, how far along was the proposal for the mine at that time?
Well, it was pretty far along. What originally happened was the state of Montana and the U.S. Forest Service never intended to engage the downstream Sandpoint communities, Clark Fork, Hope, that type of thing. And at the time, I can't remember what organization it was, but they kept lobbying the Forest Service to hold hearings in Sandpoint, and that was the beginning of Sandpoint's engagement. That was before the Rock Creek Alliance was formed.
Mm-hmm.
Mary may be able to answer this, but I do remember the draft environmental impact statement was released in, the first draft of environmental impact statement was released in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
So Mary, let's put the proposed mine in more context. Where exactly is it located, and you know, what is the extent of the proposed mine?
Well, if built, it would be constructed, as Diane said, under the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness in the Rock Creek mine drainage. It would actually be beneath Chicago Peak. Some of your listeners have probably done some hikes up near Cliff Lake and Chicago Peak. And there would be a large tailings impoundment that would be placed very close, right on the banks, actually, of the Clark Fork River. At the end of mine life, there'd be 100 million tons of mine waste. There'd be a discharge, a direct discharge from the underground mine operations into the Clark Fork River, and then a discharge from the bottom of the tailings impoundment. And, of course, all that water would flow downstream to Idaho. It's about 25 miles to Lake Ponderay. It would enter the Clark Fork River, which 90% of Lake Ponderay's water comes from the Clark Fork River. So, of course, that's one of the main concerns for the downstream communities. And as far as the project goes, there's also obviously impacts to the wilderness area. Wilderness lakes and streams would be dewatered and possibly drained. And there'd be impacts to wildlife, including threatened grizzly bears and bull trout.
So let's talk about the discharge a little bit more. How would that be treated before it was actually released into the Clark Fork?
Well, basically they, and Diane, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but they were going to use reverse osmosis in a biological treatment system. And of course there were problems inherent in both those systems. For example, without getting into a lot of detail, at cold temperatures, the biological treatment system doesn't work really well. At the end of the day, there would still be nutrient pollution, which is a problem for the water having nutrients and algae growth associated with that, and there'd be heavy metals. And so they actually were going to rely on a diffuser that would span the width of the Clark Fork River at the point of discharge, and they would have that discharge come out at several places along this diffuser so that it could be mixed and they could meet water quality standards. If they just emptied it from a pipe directly into the river, there'd be high concentrations of metals, and that would be a problem, for example, for migrating bull trout. So even though they're saying the water is treated, it's still going to be full of nutrient pollution and heavy metals. And over time, you know, those are going to come down into Lake Ponderay, and those metals are going to accumulate in the water column, in the sediment. And we really don't know long-term what the impacts of those metals are going to be. And Diane, if you want to jump in here, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that a little bit. So part of the problem with the biotreatment system that was proposed is that it's basically an experimental system, certainly for the scale of a mining operation. So it's not proven technology for water treatment for this scale of a mine. The other treatment they proposed further down the line after there was a lot of public outcry was reverse osmosis. And again, that is not a type of water treatment that's used at this scale. I mean, we're talking, you know, millions and millions of gallons of wastewater. So reverse osmosis hasn't really been proven at that scale. It involves a filter that can easily get clogged, and it also has a byproduct of salts. And so the question is, what are they doing with all this byproduct that they were planning to store in barrels and ship where? I mean, so there's all this kind of technical stuff involved with these proposed water treatment systems that really, really haven't been answered adequately by the project. And the other issue, the other discharge that's coming out of the bottom of the tailings impoundment, that is not treated water. That's a specific a discharge that's going into groundwater. There's no treatment. There's no liner underneath the tailings impoundment. It's 325 acres. It'll be 300 feet high, three times the size of the Troy Mine tailings impoundment that some folks might be familiar with. If you go on Google Earth, you can actually look up the Troy Mine tailings impoundment. It's quite the visual.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the issues with the treatment system.
So the tailings are basically the crunched up rock that's extracted, but not, you know, not used. And it can contain trace metals and pollution in it. And often you see reports of, you know, tailings impoundments that are held in water. They're ponds. Is a pond part of the proposal here, or how would the tailings be handled a little more specifically?
Diane, do you want to talk about paste?
Sure. Yeah, they're going to use what's called a paste technology. So basically, they're going to create a slurry, kind of a paste, hard to explain. It's like a paste, and they're going to, you know, basically squirt it, start building the tailings impoundment from the bottom up, and basically squirt this paste and keep building and building and building and building and building the tailings impoundment. Again, the issue is the dewatering and the stability of that paste. A lot of what came up during the public hearings and the EISs was the stability of that impoundment, particularly if there's an earthquake, when there is an earthquake-prone fault in the area, what would happen if it would basically destabilize and flow basically across the Highway 200 and into the Clark Fork River and into Rock Creek.
And I would add that the method of construction that they're using on that tailings impoundment has been shown to fail in many situations. So we had a geophysicist look at that, and he felt it was an unsafe method of construction. And, of course, we've raised that with the agencies, and they pretty much dismissed it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Dan, I know that you're going to have to leave in about 5 minutes for another appointment, but Mary and I will keep talking after you take off. I just want to throw that out there. So you've been opposing this proposed mine for 25 years, and I want to circle back on what the current status of the mine is. But while we have Diane on still, what are some of the big milestones or events that have occurred these past 25 years? I know the mine itself has actually changed hands at least a couple of times. And Diane, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, the mine's changed hand actually 4 times. One of those hand changes was the change of the name of one of the companies that purchased the mine. Current owner is Hecla. We've had a lot of interesting events that happened over the course of the last 25 years. One, of course, is getting the public hearings down in Sandpoint. We had about those first public hearings. There was about 700 people that attended in Knox and Montana and Sandpoint. Then there was a water discharge permit that was released. There was hearings held again in Knox and in Sandpoint. 2,000 public comments were received. We've had concerts, benefit concerts by Bonnie Raitt. 3 times, actually, Bonnie has performed and given proceeds to the Rock Creek Alliance. In 1998, Jackson Brown came to Sandpoint and performed at the Sandpoint Middle School. That was a sold-out deal. We had a march across the Long Bridge. That was 1,000 people attended that. We've had, you know, 3 or 4 iterations of the biological opinion by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They keep, you know, kind of messing up the biological opinion, which is tied to the EISs and the approval by the Forest Service. And so there's been a lot of really good legal work that's gone on, and we've really prevailed in a lot of those cases. Another really great thing that happened in 2004, Tiffany and Company, the jeweler, took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post criticizing the mine and taking issue with the 1872 Mining Act, which basically gives away public lands and minerals to private interests. So,
hey, that's interesting. How did Tiffany get, you know, wind of this particular project?
I'd have to defer to Mary to that.
Yeah, we've been working for really practically since we formed up. We've been working with a group called Earthworks, and they used to be called Mineral Policy Center, and they are a small nonprofit in terms of a national group. They are headquartered in D.C., and their original mission really was to reform the 1872 mining law. And so they had been reaching out to some of the jewelers, and this particular proposal, because of the implications, this would be the first mine beneath a wilderness area, really caught the attention of Michael Kowalski, who was the CEO of Tiffany and Company at the time, and Earthworks had been reaching out to him, and they, I think, basically made him aware of this project.
Mm-hmm. Dan, I know you have to take off now. Thanks for taking time to squeeze in a little bit on this. I appreciate that. And Mary,
yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, just really appreciate this this interview, Chris, and yeah, Mary will fill you in on the current status of the mine. We're still fighting. There's no mine, and doesn't look like there would be any in the near future, but I'll let Mary take off from there.
Yeah, and
thanks,
we'll be talking about the anniversary celebration coming up next week as well.
Okay, yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And Mary, so you did mention that a couple times. It's actually, the mine's going to tunnel under the established Cabinet Mountains wilderness. And Diane mentioned that there's been some biological opinions, which raises the question. So, how would the mine potentially affect some of the endangered species that are involved?
Well, in terms of grizzly bears, the major impact from the mine would be the fact that you're going to have an industrial operation basically in the heart of grizzly bear habitat. A lot of mine workers coming in and their families, people moving into the areas, a lot of folks that aren't used to living in grizzly bear country. And so the way the Fish and Wildlife Service has looked at this is they've said, well, we really can't afford any mortality in the small population of around 30 bears. So we'll mitigate by hiring a grizzly bear specialist who will teach people how to live in grizzly bear country, how to secure their garbage, the types of things that we know living in Sandpoint or northwestern Montana, how to keep bears from being attracted to our area, to our backyard. And so they hired this person several years ago. I'm trying to think, it's probably been a good 10 years. And in all that time, grizzly bear mortality has continued to increase without a mine. So currently, the status of bears is not good. We're continuing to lose bears from human-caused grizzly bear mortality. And the Fish and Wildlife Services really refuse to look at that. The other impacts are to bull trout, and basically, that would occur from reduced flows into streams that are critical for bull trout, like the East Fork of Bull River, East Fork of Rock Creek. And that is because when they excavate the underground mine, there's going to be water coming in, and they've done hydrological modeling to show that that water is going to be coming from stream reaches and lakes that are above the wilderness area. So that dewatering, in some cases, is going to be extreme, and it's going to be for hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's going to have a major impact on bull trout, as well as, heavy metals going into Rock Creek and construction-generated sediment. And these are issues that we've raised with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And as Diane indicated, there's been multiple. There's actually been six or seven biological opinions, including supplemental biological opinions. And they keep coming back with a little iteration of the original biological opinion, but they really never address the problems because they're not something that can be mitigated away. So, I don't know if you want me to get into the current state here,
Yeah,
but
let's get down. So what's the current status of the mine?
okay. Well, so as Diane said, right now there is no mine, and the last litigation that we had in terms of the biological opinion was in 2019. We basically raised this issue. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had released a 2017 supplement to their original opinion. Well, actually, it wasn't the original, it was the 2006 opinion. And again, they ignored, not only did they ignore these issues that I just described, but for the first time, they decided they were going to segment the project into phase one, which is the evaluation adit, and phase two, which is the full mine. And instead of looking at the impacts from both phases, they decided just to look at the evaluation adit because they know that most of the impacts are going to come later on. And Judge Malloy in Missoula, who's been hearing these cases for years, it didn't escape him that their tactic was to try to segment the environmental review and only look at the one phase. And he basically said, this project's been evaluated, approved, and litigated as one project with two phases since at least 2000. And so we're not going to segment this into two projects. So he basically ruled in our favor, and as a result, the biological opinion was remanded back to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then at the same time, the record of decision issued by the U.S. Forest Service that is dependent on that biological opinion, that was also pulled. So currently, there's no authorization from the Forest Service for any ground disturbing activities to occur.
So right now it's basically in stasis. It's kind of frozen where it is. Is that right?
Yes. And of course, the other development, which maybe you were going to ask me about, was sort of what Hecla's intentions are in the future.
That
And
would be the next
they
question.
basically, well, they they had a they did some press work up in Libby, and they basically said, "We're not giving up on Rock Creek, but right now we're going to focus on the Montanore project, which is also a proposed copper silver mine that would be underneath the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness, but it would be coming in on the Libby side." And so, I think at this point maybe they're frustrated because they don't have any federal authorizations, and they also don't have any state authorizations for discharging water into the river, which, we really didn't talk about that, but that was another sort of major accomplishment, was that we were able to have that discharge permit remanded back to the state agency, and they really have not done anything with that. So currently they can't do anything at Rock Creek, and so I think they're shifting their focus, but that doesn't mean they've gone away. As long as those minerals are there, we have to remain vigilant.
Well, that raises a question that proponents of mining will always raise, and we should all be cognizant of, is we do simply need minerals, so we need copper and silver and lead. How do you answer that point when it's put forth?
Well, I think there's two things, and one is there are some places that simply aren't appropriate for a mine. And in my opinion, beneath a wilderness area is not an appropriate place for a mine, and also a mine that's going to damage a major watershed, the Clark Fork Ponderay watershed. And, secondly, there's lots of copper and silver out there that can be recycled, and we're simply not doing that because it's not the attractive money-making scheme that going in and building, getting investors and going in and building a mine, speculators. There's always going to be people who want to speculate for, the mother lode and build mines, and there are better ways to do it. We simply don't need copper and silver mines at this point.
Yeah, and I'd say it's personal to the people who live here, and especially those who use our lake and want to ensure that its water quality remains as clean as possible. Well, okay, we've hashed out the mine and a bit of your history. So you have an event coming up on August 25th. It's the 25th anniversary celebration. It's going to be at Trinity at City Beach. Kicks off at 5 p.m. on Thursday. That's August 25th. It's next Thursday this airs, and it's going to run until 8:30. You're going to have music by Headwaters. And who's do you know who the Headwaters band is?
I think that it is John Edwards. I think the Edwards Park Band is now Headwaters with maybe some other musicians.
Yeah, I think that's what I understand too. And those guys are great. I've heard them a few
Yeah.
times. Yeah. What else is happening there?
Well, we have a stone skipping contest, which we did a number of years ago. I can't remember what year. I think it was like maybe 2002 or 3 that we had this stone skipping contest there at City Beach, and it was really, really popular. Folks had a really good time doing that. So we thought we'd re resurrect that as, this is obviously a celebration, and that's really what we want to focus on, is celebrating our success and, thanking everybody for supporting us. And we wanted to make this a fun event. We also have a silent auction. We do try to do that every year. That's always really popular. And we have a lot of great auction items that I think people would be interested in.
Yeah, I'm seeing a two-night stay in a cabin at Glengarry Bay, and courtesy of Marjorie Trulock at Heitman Docks. I'm seeing a two-night stay in a bell tent at Twin Cedars Camping. You get two winter lift tickets at Schweitzer. There's all kinds of artwork. There's gift baskets. There's a massage by Amy Lazotte. Sailboat cruise with Captain Steve Lazar, for those who know Steve. and a gift certificate from Lake Pend'Oreille Cruises, a bunch of other things, more than we can kind of go through here, but the silent auction is going to be happening. No host wine and beer, complimentary appetizers. So basically, it's to have some fun and celebrate 25 years of keeping Lake Pend'Oreille clean and free of that particular threat.
Absolutely, yeah, and we're also, we have a special wine that was bottled for us by Pend'Oreille Winery that will be for sale. So that's kind of a nice thing that folks can pick up a bottle of wine while they're there.
Okay, well, Mary Costello, Executive Director of the Rock Creek Alliance, what else do you want to tell us? We got just a couple minutes left.
Just that I hope, folks will come out and help us celebrate. And, if you know somebody that is new to the community and is not aware of the threats to our beautiful lake, I would encourage you to bring them along. Our event is open to the public, and we're always really happy to talk to people and, fill them in on the details. I think everybody that lives in Sandpoint, I think most people are there in large part because of Lake Pend'Oreille, and our goal is to keep it clean, and we're going to continue this fight for as long as we can. We've been here for 25 years. I think maybe we need some younger people to step in, but as long as the threat's there, we plan on continuing our work. And really grateful for having this opportunity, Chris, today to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for taking time to talk to us. And folks, remember stone skipping contest on the 25th at City Beach for the Rock Creek Alliance, along with a lot of other fun things. Mary, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Have a good day.